So the title of my talk is The 12 Tree Field Cages. And the first question I'm sure you have is, why would we want to do this? Why would we want to use large field cages to do mating disruption studies when it's so much easier not to have cages? Well, for the last number of decades, we've been doing mating disruption tests, and we never really know what the densities of our pests are. In this case, we work with moths. What the density of the moths are, either males or females. And these are almost always unknown and unregulated. And this turns out to be a problem when the mechanism of disruption is competitive attraction for the following reason. It turns out that the efficacy for competitive attraction depends on the ratio of females to dispensers. So if you have a very low number of female moths, you can get a very good effect, the lower line. And as the female density goes up, disruption can really degenerate. So I had some courses in biochemistry as a graduate student at Penn State. And reflecting on my biochemistry, a biochemist would say to deeply understand the mechanisms and kinetics of enzyme action, a biochemist would need to know and control the concentrations of enzyme, of substrate, and inhibitors, be they competitive or non-competitive inhibitors, and then measure product formation over time. I would likewise argue that a deep understanding of the mechanisms and kinetics of mating disruption, to have that, we investigators need to know and control the densities of male moths, which are in essence a mobile enzyme. Whoops. Ooh. Sorry.
Resume.
Thank you. Thank you. I right-clicked instead of left-clicked. So I'll click my way up to where I was. We need to know the density of female moths, which are equivalent to our substrate, and pheromone dispensers, equivalent to our inhibitors, and then measure the number of mated females. So in biochemistry, we use test tubes to do this. What should we be using in pheromone disruption? And I might suggest that we could use large cages. So how large would our test tubes need to be? So our group kicked us around quite a bit, and we decided that if we're using medium-sized apple trees, probably the most we can handle and keep up in wind is a 70-foot by 70-foot cage. So we elected to aim for that, and it's 10 feet high. And one of the reasons we feel comfortable with this size is that as information comes forward about what is plume size in apple orchards, it turns out it's probably more like several trees rather than many meters away. So we were fortunate to get a USDA NRI grant to fund these empirical tests of competitive attraction theory, the two big papers in chemical ecology. And so what I'll do in the remainder of the talk is describe the large field cages and how we built them, and then give results of the first couple of tests. So we built 15 of these suckers, and the first thing that you do is drill post holes and set posts. We had a semi-load of posts. These are cedar posts, about 5 inches in diameter. The best way to do it is to cement them in, so they're 3.5 feet in the ground. They're capped with a black plastic drain cap so that when we lay the netting over top, it doesn't abrade it. Then the next thing we did was went inside and we braced these posts with 2x4 construction in the stiff back construction. And the posts, the feet of the posts are braced against 6-foot metal stakes driven halfway into the ground. Then we surrounded our cage with trellis wire, one at the top, about head level, about 3 or 4 feet up, and then we put another one down here along the ground to anchor the bottom of our cages. Those of you familiar with the apple industry or fruit industry will recognize this as a gripple, and this is a quarter to give us size estimate on gripples. Gripples are wonderful things. You feed the wire through them, and they have little gripples inside that grab the wire. So you put a grippler on the ends of the wire. You spread it. It grabs the wire, and then you pull it together, and it stretches the wire and holds it there. So it was really cheap and a wonderful way to do this. Here's the arrangement of the support structure. We're looking down at a cage from the top, and so those would be the trellis wires that we configured on our 10 posts per cage. Now, before I go any further, I need to give my buddy Pete McGee a lot of credit for this. I'm known to name things, and if I were to name these cages, I would call them McGee cages, because what I wrote in the USDA NRI grant looks nothing like what Pete McGee actually came up with for how we do this. All right, so we have a support structure. The next thing we do need is to have a net. So we went with nylon shade cloth, again a Pete McGee inspiration, 40% solar reduction. We got these from International Greenhouse Company. Now, how the hell do you get these big nets on? I wanted a helicopter to come and pick them up, or a big crane, but that didn't work. So at night, thinking about it, I came up with the idea to attach these posts, an extension to these posts, and put a, a rubber wheel on the top. And we used a lathe and cut a groove in it so that we could lay a rope across it. And the idea is we have lifters, pullers way out here, and we have our rope draped down, and then we tie it onto the shade cloth and pull it up over the top. So here we are, laying an accordion folded shade cloth out. Here we are attaching it, and here are our pullers. Yes, there's one hiding in the weeds here. It took seven people to do this, three pullers, three feeders, and one pole guy in the middle. And here we go. Somebody, Pete, took command of this, and up and over we go. Here we are. Once we were up on this wheel, the net came out across it quite well. Somebody went inside with a pole and lifted the net where it was touching wires and the tree. And so we just fed it over our whole plot, and here we're just about there. And you can grab a hold of it now and pull it and center it the way you would want. Then we attach the netting to the wire with 50 of these grommets. These grommets are about 2 inches in diameter, and they have little teeth that click together. So the trellising industry had everything we would need to make our cages. We were able to make use of that. And here you can get some sense, 2 inches, and this is what the weave looked like of the nets. So here we're almost up, and then we attached with grommets and stakes, attached them to the bottom, and voila, we've got our big field cage. Very nice inside. Almost makes you want to have a wedding reception in there, actually. And we have normal culture. What I didn't say earlier is that this orchard was abandoned for 2 years. Both the owner and the farm manager died. So we caught it 2 years in and are able to rescue young trees, and they really serve our purposes. So we rent here. Now, here's the cost. You might want to know the cost. About $1,600 for supplies per cage. And the big item is the shade cloth. So, first experiment. Asking the question, what's the relationship between the density of male coddling moths released into a cage and catch in one optimized monitoring trap placed centrally, a 0.1 milligram lure and red rubber septa? Used lab-reared coddling moths from the Yakima Lab. Thanks, guys, if anybody is here. Thank you very much. We used 6 of these cages. Coddling moth densities you can see right here. We used males that were 2 to 4 days post-eclosion. No females in this experiment. Catch occurred over the next 4 days following release, and then we replicated this test 3 times over 5 weeks. Release of the moths. We just went up to near a tree, dumped the moths out in our hand, wiggled our fingers, and allowed them to take off, and they readily took off. The vast preponderance of them went straight into the tree canopies, and soon you couldn't see them. They were very obscured in there. So we had a uniform release through our cages. And this is the results of the first experiment, the error bars, standard error. X-axis coddling moth males released, Y-axis our catch over 4 days. And you can see we got a very tight linear relationship, which is very encouraging. And you can see from the slope that we caught back in 4 days half of our males. So we certainly don't get them all. We got back half of them. But their behavior at the various densities is very consistent. And again, what we're looking at is this competitive attraction equation and making sure we've got things figured out correctly, which for male density, that experiment helped us know that we do. Very quickly, next question, do we get a pure competitive attraction profile when deploying pheromone dispensers of equal attractiveness to that of the trap? Our moths came from here, 6 cages. These were our densities of dispensers. 96 males released, no females. Catch over the next 4 days. And I don't have time to go into it, but the blue diamonds are the pure competitive attraction, and the pink open squares are the data that we got back. And it's very encouraging. Yes, pure competitive attraction took place in these big cages. Here's a so-called Miller-Goot plot. Again, very nice match predicted to the theoretical, and a Miller-Delam plot. So, indeed, competitive attraction operates in these cages, preparing us to go on and really investigate the nuances. So, final conclusion here, the large cage approach is working wonderfully for our purposes. We expect to go on and evaluate our competitive attraction equations, and I think we'll produce data that are at a new level of reliability and precision by taking control of these factors. And my final prediction would be someday every pheromone company will want to have their products evaluated and rated. So finally, we can get something we've never had, and that is a level playing field to really compare products to one another. Thank you.
One quick question.
Yes, Tom Baker. There's something I tell graduate students, and that when you're designing experiments, you get to choose sometimes what you're actually going to do, and the term I use for it is investigator's prerogative. And so in this case, we're invoking investigator's prerogative as a place to just get started. So Tom, your question is a really good one. I'm sure the presence of the cages do something, and we're measuring this with various sensors. Wind velocity, certainly the presence of the cage changes things a little bit. The temperature's not very different, but the wind flow would be different in there. But we're electing to hold these parameters reasonably constant and then go ahead and do our work. And we are not extrapolating directly to what happens outside. You've got to get a hold of things somewhere, get your test tubes clean, and get started on it, and then we'll build up from there. Thanks.
All right.